We continue this series of studies on Nehemiah. We come to Nehemiah chapter 6. And this evening's message is entitled Conspiracy Against the Leader. Remember that we are covering events of the year starting 445 BC. If we remember that Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian emperor, came down to attack Judah 3 times in 20 years. And the last time that he came was in 568 BC. That means by the time 445 BC, it is over 100 years, which means that Nehemiah was one who was most likely born in Babylon and raised up there, schooled there, and was used to life there. Then he rose up high to become the king's cupbearer. Of course, there is the other possibility that he could have been born in Jerusalem, and along the way, in the intervening period, he was brought by his parents to Babylon. That is a possibility. But more likely than not, we say that Nehemiah was born and raised up in Babylon. Now remember, by the time Nehemiah came to serve the king, a new empire was in power. The Medo-Persian Empire has taken over the Babylonian Empire. And you remember how Nehemiah was burdened for the work in Jerusalem, and he prayed to God. He fasted because the situation there was not good. The walls of Jerusalem were in disrepair. The people were discouraged. He prayed and he fasted. He was a man whose heart was with God's people, with God's kingdom. So it is like today, we should be mission-minded. We should be concerned for the welfare of the local church. We should be concerned for the spread of the gospel elsewhere. We can't be involved in all works throughout the world, but there are certain works done by like-minded churches which we should be involved in, at the very least to be informed and to be praying for the work. So Nehemiah was such a man, and God was going to use him. And when the king noticed that his countenance was sad, the king said, "This is a problem of the heart." You see, so what is it? And Nehemiah was frightened at that time, because you couldn't be unhappy in the sight of the king. It is as though you are unhappy with the king's provision, it's not enough, or you are unhappy with serving the king, or what? So the likelihood of the king flying into a temper and have you executed was very high. Nehemiah quickly shot up an arrow prayer to God, and he answered the king, and the king was receptive to him. The king asked him what he needed, what he wanted. Nehemiah said, "If it is possible, allow me to lead a group of Jews back to rebuild the walls." So that was how Nehemiah was sent back to Babylon, and his was the third batch of Jews who went back. And he quietly surveyed the place, and then he called the leaders together, and after hearing them, he began to plan for action. And he systematically planned for the walls to be built, but we know that the enemies were very unhappy, as you can see in chapter 2, verse 10. And they engage in ridicule and insinuation, as you can see in chapter 2, verse 19. And when that did not work, they began to engage in intimidation. They threatened. And indeed, they were planning to go and attack them suddenly and cause chaos there, and perhaps have one or two killed, and then the bad name will come upon Nehemiah and his people. Then perhaps the emperor in Babylon would put a stop to the work. But as it turned out, Nehemiah did not want to be frightened. And along the way, we learned that there are two very common weapons used by Satan against God's people. He wants to instill fear in his people, and he wants to instill discouragement in his people. And often, if you are not fearful of your own life, your family's life, or your reputation, or your career, or any other thing, you have the fear of men. Cripple many a useful servant of God. But if you are not frightened, as Martin Luther was not frightened, and others through history were not frightened, see, then Satan uses the other weapon, that is discouragement. And discouragement is a very powerful weapon, see. It drains you of the motivation to do anything. It causes you to be limped. What you know in your mind, you try to justify not doing, you see. So Nehemiah was aware of these twin problems. And the devil also attacked from without and then from within. And we discovered that when the enemies couldn't bring about fear and discouragement to the people of God, then the devil now uses discouragement and disunity from within the people of God. So the people came complaining to Nehemiah, okay, about their farms being neglected, about them having to pay heavy taxes to the king of Babylon, about their daughters having to be sold off. And obviously that was exaggerated, but there was great difficulty on their part. They really were on the verge of having to think of various ways of paying money, paying taxes, and finding more money. So all this was a great discouragement to the people. And if this attitude of being disgruntled spread throughout God's people, it was going to be difficult for Nehemiah. So Nehemiah pondered about the situation. He did not act rashly, but he absorbed everything, spent time in prayer. Then he addressed the problem at the butt. He nipped the problem at the butt. He called the nobles together and rebuked them and persuaded them, pleaded with them, why these are our brethren, why are you charging them more than is necessary, and why are you charging interest when the law of God does not permit that, see? And so the combination of all these internal problems brought about the near disunity of the people. But all in all, Nehemiah was led by God, given the wisdom, the discernment, and the courage to do what was right. So everything was kept well, intact. See? And Nehemiah taught them to build with one hand while the other hand was ready to pull up the weapon to defend themselves. Nehemiah also organized a system of watching out for enemies, and he had the trumpet blower beside him, and he would be observing everywhere. He would be going his rounds. If there was any signal, for example, from a party of danger, Nehemiah will confirm, and once confirmed, his trumpet will blow, and when he points, you see, people will know. You see. So we can imagine something like that happening. But Nehemiah definitely had his trumpet blower beside him, and he was watching everywhere. So imagine one person with his trumpet blower, how could he cover all the walls? He obviously had arranged a system of signaling that wherever the enemies was found, it was to be known, made known to him, signaled to him, and if he confirmed that it's true, he was going to ask the trumpet to be blown, and then he would direct the people to that place, to defend that place. So all in all, Nehemiah was a very good administrator, and a godly man. He constantly prayed to God, but he was not so holy to the point that he was useless. He really knew the importance of acting in faith. Right? Now, tonight we come to another attack. This time it is directed at Nehemiah himself. The leader himself was the target of attack. And we are going to learn to expect such attacks, to recognize such attacks, and to withstand such attacks. What is the point of expecting attacks, and then when attacks come, you don't know what to do? What is the point of recognizing such attacks, and when it comes, when the attacks come, you don't know what to do? So we want to expect, recognize, and withstand such attacks. So let us look at the various sections. In verse 1 to verse 4, we learned of the enemies using the soft approach. Look at verse 1 to verse 4. We see Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem the Arab, this treason, this unholy trinity. You know, they came together again, okay? And they managed to garner together other enemies so that they appear stronger. And then they heard that Nehemiah had almost completed the wall, only the gates needed to be hung. You see, the hooks were there. So once you take the gates and hang on, you may regard the wall as complete. So perhaps the hook at that time has not been put, therefore the gates could not be hung up. But nevertheless, the enemy saw that the wall was virtually complete. And then Sanballat and Geshem came, saying, come, let us meet together among the villagers in the plain of Ono. And Nehemiah straightway sensed that they intended to do him harm. All this while, they had been planning to do harm to the Jews and also to Nehemiah. Why, on this occasion, when the wall was nearly complete, would they want to meet as though for peace? You see? And if they had waited that long for until the wall was nearly complete, Nehemiah knew that they could wait a week or so later, perhaps, until the wall was complete. So why at this point? See? So Nehemiah knew that he shouldn't go. And you know that when you study the map of the region at that time, you discover that Ono, where they wanted to meet with him, was a day's journey away west from Jerusalem, near the border of Samaria and Philistia. So if Nehemiah were to go, it would take one day to go there, meet with them minimum one day, to come back again another day, then 3 days of work would not be done. But more important than that, Nehemiah smelled a rat. So he therefore said in his mind, "Oh no," he said, "I'm not going there. So you want me to meet at in the Ono?" So in English we will say, "Oh no, I'm not going there," you know. So he sent his message back. You know, whoever got the message, he sent a message back to say, "Sorry, I'm not going. You see, I'm doing a great work," verse 3, "so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it to go down to you?" And you know, these people were so persistent. They sent messengers to invite him to have this meeting 4 times, imagine. Look at verse 4. And many of us, if we are weaker individuals, we hesitate, you know, maybe they want peace. They really are sincere. They come 4 times, you know. 2 times is already bad enough for me. Now 3 times, really, I should go with them. But 4 times, you know, how can I withstand the 4 times I should go? But Nehemiah said no in his heart. He said no, he wouldn't go. Okay? And that was what he did. The question is, what would you have done if you were in Nehemiah's position? Any character who is weaker than Nehemiah would have succumbed to this overture. Wow, they perhaps come with such you know, pleasing tones and speak so nicely and so softly after they have been so nasty all this year. Wow. So they might put it as though you are the one who is stubborn, who do not want to give in. And in Christian language, people can turn around and say, "You are such an unforgiving person. Shouldn't Christians be forgiving?" See? Oh, you know, Christians should be known for their love. Christians are known for their love. Why are you so unloving? So come, you know, let us meet. See? So all in all, you see that this was Satan's clever strategy to get us diverted from the work of God by meeting with the enemies of the gospel. And in modern day gospel work, you discover people, church leaders, are drawn away by dialogues and to have unity talks and interfaith dialogues with others and so on. And to me, it's very clear cut. We learn from Nehemiah, we learn from other parts of the Bible, other characters in the Bible. From the teaching of the Bible, it's clear cut. Certain things we just have to say, "Thank you for inviting me, but I can't go." Say, why can't you go? "I'm sorry, I'm busy in God's work. Anyway, I have no time to talk, but thank you for inviting me." Just yesterday, say, a call came to invite us to join a certain meeting. "Have you heard of this group?" I said, "Yeah, yes. What do you want?" Say, "We would like to invite your church to participate in this meeting." I said, "Oh, thank you for inviting, but we can't go." Before he could say why and so on, I say, "Thank you for inviting. Good day." So finish, conversation over. And it's not because we are narrow-minded, it is because we are rigid, because we lack love, like what others have been saying all these years. Yes, from the beginning of our church life, from the very beginning when the first church was planted, you see, people spread around the word that the Reformed Baptists are narrow, that they are isolating themselves, you see, and words like that were spreading around. And some of our more reasonable friends heard this type of stories about us. They came to us and very upset. And one of them even went to one church leader who was working in the income tax department and made an appointment to see him and say, "You know, The Reformed Baptists are my friends. I know them personally. I know the pastor. See, they are not like what you are saying. See? And the man was so apologetic. It's our members who are saying this, but we in the leadership of our church, we never spread this type of things. You see? So there are negative things. There have been negative things spread about us simply because we want to make a stand for the truth. We want to be faithful to God. We are clear that the church has only one commission. It is to uphold and propagate the truth. We are not here to have ecumenical meetings with other churches and to consider making a stand as the Church of Malaysia in this present political climate and so on and so forth. We really have no time for that.
See?
And we mustn't be diverted. We must be clear-minded about this matter. It is actually Satan's way of diverting us from the work of God. See? Imagine our membership is small. Our work is so much. God has given us so many opportunities to do His work. See? If the pastor and the elders of the church were to attend some of these meetings, see? Every single meeting attended is time taken away from God's work. And as it is, we are already hard-pressed to do so much of God's work. See? We have hardly time to do the work. The needs are so great. Yeah? And here are people trying to form committees and making a common stand and things like that. We really have to nicely, politely say to them, thank you for inviting us, but we really can't go. See? There's no need for us to give any reason why. There was a time when we were pressed. Why can't... There was a different occasion. I was invited to preach in the full gospel assembly and nicely say to the men, you know, thank you for inviting me. I feel honored, but I'm afraid I can't go. And the pastor insisted and said, but why can't you come? He said, come and preach to us. See? He said, our theology are different. Our theologies are different. We have different emphases, and it's impossible for us to work together. See? And he emailed back to say, point taken. Okay, so it was understood. So it is important that we make a stand. Yeah? So we don't be rude to people. Yeah, and we don't think too highly of ourselves. They think we are thinking too highly of ourselves, but we are not. You see, we are so small compared to others. We are so weak financially. But we have much work to do. Our eyes should be focused on gospel work. See, we don't want to be involved in this meeting and that meeting. Okay, be clear about this. Let's move on. We come to the second section, verse 5 to verse 9. The enemies use the hard approach. Once the soft approach did not work, they use the hard approach. It is like wanting the donkey to cross the narrow bridge to the other side of the river. So you dangle a carrot in front of the donkey, and if as the donkey tries to go forward to bite the carrot, then he will cross. And if he still doesn't want, then you use the other incentive. You beat him from behind. So the carrot and the stick will bring the donkey across. So they thought. So since the carrot did not work, they now swung the big stick. They thought that they would come and frighten Nehemiah. So Sanballat sent the message the fifth time. And this time it was an open letter so that others knew the content. So that it would appear bad on the part of Nehemiah that he was not responding to such a cordial request to come and meet, to have a peace meeting, see. And because it became public like that, they thought that Nehemiah will be untwisted to comply, see. And this time they really wielded the big stick. They claimed, firstly, that it was reported among the nations. All the people around can confirm it. Huh? And even Geshem, the well-known Arab, who had aligned himself with nobility and other people. You know, Geshem also says, wow, you mentioned the Arab Geshem. You know, they thought that Nehemiah would get frightened that such a prominent individual could be involved. And then it was claimed that they were planning to rebel against the king of Babylon, the emperor. See? And Nehemiah was going to proclaim himself king, which means that he was going to challenge the powers of the Medo-Persian Empire. See? And that, they believe, would frighten Nehemiah, because if this charge were to really be brought to the king in Babylon, certainly the king will begin to have doubts about Nehemiah unless he really trusted Nehemiah, knew Nehemiah's character. But these people were threatening to send such a report to the king in Babylon. See? And they call these rumors when in fact they themselves are manufacturing the rumors. These really, we say, rascals. You know? They really are very good at misinformation. They are very good at playing psychology. Yeah? And you see, now through the centuries, this has been going on. We thought that it is only a modern thing, using internet and alternative news and so on. You spread charges and counter charges. All this has been happening long ago. Yeah? So here you see this working full time. You see, they were manufacturing rumors and trying to fan the rumor. Yeah? And then you note that they claimed that Nehemiah had appointed a prophet to proclaim that Nehemiah was going to be king. See? And to make it sound more authentic, that a prophet of God has himself announced that Nehemiah was going to be king. And of course, all this was manufactured by them. And Nehemiah was not going to waste time answering them point for point. You see, we thought, you know, wow, the right way is to counter them each point so that they are left with nothing to say. And in some situations, that would be necessary. But in the current situation, Nehemiah was very wise indeed. And often, we are faced with a situation like this. To reply thoroughly so that the person who is manufacturing all these allegations would be shut up once and for all? Or would we be falling into the trap of showing that we are now being affected? Then we are giving our enemies the pleasure of knowing that they are making an impact upon us. You see? Now this is where you must learn to weigh things up. So Nehemiah must obviously have struggled over this and prayed over this and consulted the other leaders over it, and he came to the conclusion that he shouldn't waste time answering them point for point. So in verse 8, he just sent back the message, no such things as you say are being done, but you invent them in your own heart. You see? So instead of giving them the pleasure of knowing that Nehemiah was upset by the allegations, Nehemiah was able to turn back upon them so that they became the ones upset because Nehemiah appeared not dented in any way. Okay? So all in all, there are things that are so fine but so subtle but so real that we must learn. Okay? And you see now that if Nehemiah had answered in detail, it would drain him of time and emotional energy. Then secondly, it wouldn't have stopped the enemies, but it would make them happy instead. And thirdly, he would unwittingly be helping them to spread and prolong the rumors. Can you not see all these points? You see? So we learn from this the lesson. The devil is good at striking at vulnerable points. You know, in martial arts, we learn the vulnerable points on bodies. And through the centuries of development of the martial arts, especially in China, we know that on the main body there are 36 vital points. And out of these 36, you can strike, see, anywhere in the middle line, you know that you will fall even the biggest enemy. See? And of course, there are 108 points that we learn how to strike when we are doing martial arts. See? Even in a hand that's striking you. You strike his hand at a certain point and his hand will go numb. See? But you must know. You must know how to attack. See? And in so far as the Christian life is concerned, the devil knows us through and through. He has studied us through and through, and he knows each one of us where our vulnerable point is, where our weak point is, and he knows how to strike. And we have learned already that the two common weapons of the devil is to instill fear and to bring discouragement. And so many times in this chapter, Nehemiah was aware that fear and discouragement was being put upon him. He was resisting these twin weapons of the devil. See? And so learn this, that Nehemiah, who was not, he was as it were, although we say the prophet Nehemiah, but he was sent back to Jerusalem more as a political leader, as an administrative leader. Ezra was more the prophet and the scribe helping him at that point. But Nehemiah is regarded as the prophet because of what he wrote down, okay, in and is included in the book as a book of the Bible. So we regard him as a prophet. But when he was sent back to Jerusalem, his official position was that of an administrator. Okay? But he was a very godly man and very capable man. And if Nehemiah were charged as wanting to be king, that is treason. Huh? That is like, you know, you are challenging the position of the Babylonian, the Persian king, the Medo-Persian king. Okay? And through history, we discover this has always been done. Church leaders are charged with treason, with heresy, mishandling of money, immorality, things of this nature. See? Have you not heard? Of course, leaders of the church are vulnerable. They are exposed, and they are in the limelight. And often the slightest problem will be magnified. See, people forget that they are human beings like others. They have needs like others. For example, you see, they have to raise up a family. Often are short of money. See, they are tempted to want to earn extra somewhere. See, and then if they do some job somewhere, you know, people will accuse the pastor. You know, oh, you know, he still want to make money. You know, he's not doing his job well. He's not focusing full time in the job. You see. So temptations like that often come to the pastor. People forget that they are human like anybody. They are tempted in various directions. So the slightest mistake will be magnified by the enemies of the gospel. Okay? And charges of immorality, charges of this heresy, charges of treason, all these have been leveled against church leaders. So we must be aware that of the enemy's tactic. We come to section number 3. The enemies used the spiritual approach, verse 10 to verse 14. Now what happened is that in verse 10, which is afterward, I came to the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Nehatabel. Now he was a secret informer, and he said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. Indeed, at night they will come to kill you. Now, these were people known to Nehemiah. Nehemiah knew them well. Nehemiah treated them as friends. They were the people of God. They were in fact intimate friends. To be able to talk to Nehemiah like that and to invite him to the temple to keep himself safe. There is the idea that if you are in danger of your life, you go into the temple to hide, and that is a sacred sanctuary. Your enemies must think twice before they desecrate the temple area by killing anyone there. See? Remember Joab, the army commander of David, when he knew that he was in trouble when Solomon came to power, he ran to the temple and hung on to the horn of the altar, thinking that Solomon would therefore not kill him. But Solomon was a person who was wise and righteously ruthless. God raised him up to be a powerful king, and he had to do what was right. He just gave the order, go him, take him out, kill him. See? So no mercy for a man who had for many years held his father to ransom. See? So David was of course foolish to fall into the hand of Joab, and all these years had been blackmailed by Joab. But before David passed away, he told Solomon, beware of this man. See? And Solomon dealt with Joab. He deserved to die. And therefore, Joab he failed, thinking that the temple would protect him, but he didn't. But here, the same idea was operating. So Nehemiah's good Jewish friends were saying, they are going to come and kill you tonight. Let's go and hide in the temple. And Nehemiah knew that if he were to go as they suggested, not only will he be showing himself to be a coward and the word will get out and soon people will have a bad image of Nehemiah, then their confidence in Nehemiah will be shaken. But Nehemiah also can't be sure that he will be safe there. And as it turned out, this person who first suggested that was a secret informer of his enemies. So if Nehemiah had complied and gone in, not only what would his reputation be broken, be shaken, and therefore the confidence of the people in him will be shaken, but he might actually die in there. Okay? So Nehemiah was right when he made the stand in verse 11. Should such a man as I flee, and who is there such as I who would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. Now you must not read this as a proud man talking, but rather he had worked out all the principles. He saw, verse 12, then I perceived that God had not sent him at all, but that he pronounced this prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. Nehemiah knew all along that all this sounds fishy. And if the Lord has preserved him thus far, so far, would he now just run away and not trust in the Lord? Things just didn't jive, so Nehemiah did not want to go in. Okay? And he knew that the moment he did so, he could keep himself safe. Even that was not guaranteed, more likely he would be killed in the temple. Okay? But let us say, if he were to keep himself safe, see, the word would have gone out. People's respect for him would have gone. And if Nehemiah had to run to the temple to seek refuge there, what about the rest of the Jews? Yeah. That means if they are in danger now with no leader to guide them, Nehemiah knew that it would affect the morale of the people very badly. Okay? And this, all in all, you discover that the enemy failed. And when he became convinced that the enemies actually hired this Jew, Nehemiah was assured that he had done the right thing. And often it is like this. We waver, we pray, then we have to make the decision. But always make the decision that is pleasing to God, that is consistent with the teaching of His Word, and leave the consequences to God. Just like what C.H. Spurgeon said, do what is right and leave the consequences to God. Yeah. And we really need to have that courage, that discernment, see, and that decisiveness of Nehemiah, see, when in such a situation. Look at verse 14. You see, Nehemiah really had prayed to God, and when everything was over, he could thank God for it. My God, remember Tobiah and Sanballat according to these, their works and the prophecies of Noadiah, the rise of the prophets who would have made me afraid. They were constantly using this one of the twin weapons. Make him afraid or make him discouraged. Make him afraid, make him discouraged. Hey, thank God that a man like Nehemiah really had courage, had discernment, and he was decisive in acting on what he believed to be right. He had faith in God and did what was right. At the same time, you can imagine how he was tossed about while making the decision and how he had prayed. See, but he made the decision correctly and he was spared from being killed. The potential of him being killed was very great there. Then we consider verse 15 to verse 19, the outcome. We have the pleasant news that in 52 days since starting rebuilding the wall, it was completed after the years of being in disrepair. It shows that if the people of God had put their heart to the work and worked in unity, they would have been successful. But because they did not put their heart to it, they did not work in unity, the work was not done for years. Okay? And Nehemiah could indeed have turned around and said, you see, it could be done. All this could have been done long ago. You see? But Nehemiah was, of course, not a man to come and rub it in. But he just reports to us factually that the work was done in 52 days. Wow! Imagine, 52 days! Wow! Less than 2 months and the work was done. The wall, the whole wall of the city at that time. See? And what happened now? Instead of the Jews being disheartened, the enemies became disheartened, for they now could see that Jehovah was with his people. See? Look at verse 16. And it happened when all our enemies heard of it, and all the nations around us saw these things, that they were very disheartened in their own eyes, for they perceived that this was done by our God. Wow, wow. See, it could have turned the other way, and the enemies have, you know, become triumphant, see, as the work was stopped. But Nehemiah did not allow that to happen. He prayed to his God and he acted correctly. Huh? And so in that short time, the work was done. And the work was done despite severe opposition. But certainly, God was with his people. Nehemiah knew that God uses instruments, human instruments, but all the glory must be returned to God. But that did not mean that all the troubles went. You look at the nagging troubles that lingered among God's people, verse 17 to verse 19. The nobles were still in touch with Tobiah, see? And you note that they were pledged to him despite all the problems, verse 18. That means they were loyal to Tobiah. And Tobiah, as we have learned, was an Ammonite by ethnic origin. But he became a nominal Jew by marriage. His family was married here, married there to Jewish, prominent Jewish families. So in that way, he's like orang Yahudi sesat. This is in name. I almost say Kelabit sesat, but I say I'm a Kelabit sesat. But no, I know this is a Yahudi sesat. You know, this man claimed that, you know, I better explain a little. You know, in early days, we had some interactions with the Kelabit people in the highlands, and then they have this adoption ceremony, and then I was adopted there, given a name and so on. But we know that this is just their custom, and along the way, I just joked that I was a Kelabit sesat. Yeah? So a Kelabit who has gone astray. Yeah? So Tobiah was such a man. He was not a Jew, but he was orang Yahudi sesat. He was considered a Jew by virtue of marriage, not because he was really a Jew. Okay? And you note that they continued to communicate, and the information war, psychological warfare continued. They came and reported what Tobiah was planning so that the news would shake Nehemiah. And what Nehemiah said and what he was doing was reported back to Tobiah. And it was very disconcerting to know that information is going to and fro like that, see? So we learned the lesson that when the major problem is solved, we wish that it will be clean, that there will be no leftover things to deal with. But it's not the case. Often in church work, you discover when the problem is over, there is a lingering problem. It is like you throw a stone into the water, it splashes, and then the ripples continue for some time. So expect the ripples. But one thing that should comfort us is the fact that when we do what is right and pleasing to God, the gospel will advance, the truth will be established. And that is our comfort, that when the gospel advances, although there are still problems, nevertheless, we know the gospel has advanced, our hearts are comforted. So all in all, what else should we learn? We know that Satan tries various methods to discourage his people and hinder their work. And he also attempts to attack key men in God's work. Now, some closing lessons to us are, firstly, be aware that problems will come when gospel work is progressing, and we must not be diverted from the main work that we are to do to advance the gospel. And secondly, be aware of Satan's strategy. He strikes from without, then from within. Then he tries to disrupt the unity. Then he attacks the leaders. Then he uses the soft approach. Then he changes to the hard approach. Then he uses a worldly approach. Then he will turn to the spiritual approach. So he alternates using all these different approaches. And the thing is, we must learn to identify the key players or the key agents used by Satan. Tobiah was the clever strategist. Sanballat was the active executioner and Geshem was the quiet accuser. And it is like trying to understand that in the book of Revelation, Satan often uses three agents. And the prophet that arises from the sea, namely civil authorities persecuting the church. The prophet that arises from the earth, namely heretical teaching disturbing the peace of the church. Okay? And then, of course, Babylon, the harlot. This represents worldly allurement that draws people's hearts away. Okay? So we must learn to identify the key players in Satan's army. So be careful. Then finally, pray for discernment. Pray for perseverance in the faith. And pray that we do not unwittingly become used by our enemies. And of course, don't succumb to the enemy's persistence. We must persevere. So with these thoughts, we come to the end of tonight's study. Have you any questions or comments?